So I'd like to thank the organizers very much for inviting me, allowed me to decompress after several days before this, where I was somewhat less interesting but more frantic exercise in Canadian science funding that some of you know about. So I had planned to say that there was going to be not very much connection between this talk and the other talks in this meeting, although actually it turns out that there's a little bit of overlap with the last talk, and that at the very end, if I get to it, I'll mention something about Erdős-Rényi random graphs, which also came up from the last talk. But mostly I'm going to talk about spin glasses with spatial structure. So let me tell you what they are. It will help if you if you've seen easing models before. Spin glasses are disordered easing models. The energy function or Hamiltonian for an easing model, the usual one, does not have any random terms in it, but in a spin glass, the coefficients that appear are themselves random. So here's the energy function for a spin glass. This is the sum over nearest neighbor pairs in ZD. The basic variables take the values plus or minus 1. These are real numbers. In the classical easing model, this would just be replaced by a positive constant. That would be the easing ferromagnet. In all these cases, this is a sort of formal expression. In order to define things, one first takes a finite system, truncates the sum to a finite sum. One has to worry about boundary conditions, which I'll mostly ignore. They'll be in the background. And then takes a limit in which one gets a well-defined probability measure on configurations of plus or minus ones on all of ZD. The disordered models are ones in which these coefficients are themselves random, and then one is usually dealing with what's called quench disorder. That's the case in which typical models are ones in which these are IID random variables. They're sort of chosen from that product measure once and for all, and then they're thought of as fixed. And then one studies the easing model with this energy function for that choice of the couplings, and hopefully tries to prove something that's valid for almost every choice of the couplings. So that's called quench disorder. These are IID random variables from some distribution. There's a class of models called disordered ferromagnets, which are much easier and much better understood than spin glasses. Those are ones where, even though these are random, they're taken from they're not negative or positive. The spin glasses are ones where this can be positive or negative, and the canonical case is one where it's as likely to be positive or negative. And the two most usual examples are taken either from a standard normal distribution or taking plus or minus some constant value with probability a half, J is positive. I'm going to talk about kind of general things where it doesn't make much difference which of these one looks at, or more general ones. I'm going to, at the very end, I'll mention some numerical results. I don't even remember if it, I think the numerical results were done with this example. So what kinds of things does one want to study? So one chooses these constants that appear in the energy function from the product measure. And then they're thought of as fixed, so let's say, so then you choose these and then keep that realization, I'll call it script J, fixed. And you would like to prove, prove something about the easing model with that realization of the energy function. You'd like to prove that something almost surely. I have to prove things almost surely with respect to the choice of this J. So what kinds of things? What kinds of things does one want to study? Particularly one would want to study Gibbs measures or Gibbs distributions. Which are the form e to minus beta times the energy function. It's a probability measure on configurations of plus or minus 1. I could put in the, let's put in the J there, and then normalize. As I said, to make proper sense out of this, you should first do this in a finite subset of ZD, and then take a limit. Infinite volume means, and after taking that limit, and I'll write down one specific example of a question, which will be the one that I'd like to talk about. And I'm not going to talk about any. I'm going to talk about an approach to this problem. So here's an example of one of the many open problems. This subject, even though it's been around for decades in the physics literature, there are not many rigorous results. Prove that. So the phenomenon of phase transitions, which was also briefly mentioned in the last talk, in the case of easing type models, phase transition roughly corresponds, or one version of a phase transition is that for beta small, beta is the inverse temperature parameter, for beta small, no matter how you take the infinite volume limit, no matter what sorts of boundary conditions you take, in the limit there's a unique infinite volume Gibbs measure. For small beta, if there's a phase transition, that would mean that for large enough beta, you get multiple possible limits depending on things like boundary conditions. We'll describe that a little slightly differently in a moment, but so prove that you have a phase transition in some appropriate dimension. Appropriate dimension would be 3, for example. Prove that for some d, for example 3, and some large value of the inverse temperature parameter beta, but still finite. Rather than saying there are multiple ones, I'll say it something which implies that. Notice that the this type of energy function has the property that it's invariant under the transformation, which all the spin variables, the plus or minus ones, are changed by a minus sign for all of them, right? Since it's quadratic, that doesn't change the energy. So the energy is invariant under such a what's called a global spin flip. And certainly, if you took a finite system without any boundary conditions, the probability measure, the Gibbs measure, would also be invariant under the global spin flip. The question of whether you have multiple possible limiting distributions is closely related to the question of whether you have any infinite volume Gibbs measures which are not invariant under this global flip. So that's the way I'll formulate this. Show that there exists an infinite volume Gibbs measure, which I'll call alpha, which is not invariant under a global spin flip. The physicists would call that a broken spin flip symmetry. So in particular, that the expectation in this measure of a single one of these variables is not zero. So the I'll use the physics notation for the expectation. Expectation in this probability measure, I'll write that way. So this thing is not identically zero. That is, there are at least some x's for which this isn't zero. And this is notation for expectation in the probability measure alpha. Let me tell you some things which are rigorously known, but not very much. For beta small, in any dimension of beta small enough, or in one dimension for any finite beta, Gibbs state is unique. The Gibbs measure, infinite volume Gibbs measure is unique. And once it's unique, of course, this has to be zero because if you have any Gibbs measure, if you do the transformation, which you change all the sigmas by minus sign, that's another Gibbs measure. And if you get the same one, then the expectation had to be zero. Yes? Alpha is an infinite volume Gibbs measure. It's the same thing, except that I'm not being too careful about indicating values in the random variables. This is the random variable whose value is plus or minus one at a given site. Maybe I should say a word about, in the case where you have an Ising ferromagnet, where all the, let's say instead of these random JXYs, you just had plus three, in that case, you know that the lower energy configurations, which are the most likely ones when beta is large, are ones where the sigma variables tend to be the same as each other. And then if you take a limit in which you do, in which you say take plus boundary conditions and then take the limit as that goes away, then this thing will tend to be in two or more dimensions. It's known that this thing will then be strictly positive in that case, or if you took the opposite boundary conditions, you'd get something that would be negative. Here, these JXYs, some are positive, some are negative, things like to be related to their neighbors in a certain way. If there's a positive JXY, then they like to be the same as that neighbor. If there's a negative JXY, they like to be the opposite of that neighbor. And so even if there's ordering, which this corresponds to, then the ordering would have a very complicated spatial structure. I mean, there would be certain, but things would tend to be, be more likely to disagree with these neighbors and agree with those neighbors. And one of the basic problems in spin glasses is that you don't have a very much of a picture of what low energy configurations look like. So you're trying to prove something in which you don't really understand the natural structure of the low energy configurations. One of the ways of doing that, and that will come up in the approach that I'm going to talk about, involves what are called replicas. That is to say, take a sample of size 2 from your Gibbs measure and then try to compare the two configurations with each other and see whether they tend to be like each other. And that's a way of seeing whether there's some kind of ordering going on. Yes?
What do you mean non-random? Do you think for negative
non-random? First of all, there are two sources of randomness in the problem. There's the randomness of the couplings. Those are chosen random to start with, and then they're fixed. For a given set of couplings, you still have a probability measure. That's this alpha. So there's the randomness from that. That's a so-called thermal randomness. And these are expectations. Of course, once you take expectations that this thing, you've averaged over this measure, but you still have, this still depends upon the couplings. So a sort of quantity that one might look at to, one might take this quantity at the origin, say, that still depends upon the couplings, and then one might, well, it's not a good idea to average it over the couplings, because then you'd be averaging positive and negative things. You might square it first and then average over the couplings and try to show that that's non-zero. That's a good question. So let me just restate your question and then try to answer it. So suppose instead of taking the case, let's say, where you're plus or minus j with probability 1/2, you take the case where you're plus j with probability 0.51 and minus j with probability 0.49. So there it's something which a little bit prefers neighbors to agree with each other. That modest changes in the distribution, so it's not quite symmetric, the distribution of the JXYs, but close to it, have not led to any rigorous results. And in fact, according to the general wisdom in the physics literature, such as it is, it's believed that for small asymmetries that behaves like the symmetric case. If you have a large asymmetry, then in fact you can start doing things and showing that it's not much different than the case where you just have plus j. So this is one thing that's known. And once it's unique, then the average of any odd function of the sigmas has to be zero. And there's some other things one can say, but not much else is known rigorously. I should say that from the physics point of view, or the physicist's point of view, this question is not considered, I mean, this is regarded as interesting, but it's not considered controversial. That is, everybody believes, primarily based on numerical work, which is very difficult itself, that such a phase transition happens. But there are very serious disagreements involving further questions about if this non-uniqueness happens, what is the sort of structure of the set of the Gibbs measures? There's a lot of dispute. This is a subject in which one reason I got involved in it some years ago is that, unlike much of many topics in theoretical physics that mathematical physicists work on, where they're at a big disadvantage in the sense that the theoretical physicists, you know, do some non-rigorous argument and then 10 or 15 years later maybe there's a rigorous result related to it. In this case, this most questions about the system, this is somewhat different than most things, it seems to be almost equally difficult either to prove something about them or to argue non-rigorously but convincingly, or to do numerical studies, which are also extremely difficult for various reasons in spin glasses. So I thought it was a more level playing field. And it's been borne out at least by the fact that nobody's gotten very far. So why am I talking about it? Well, I want to describe an approach to phase transitions for Ising models, which has been very successful in the simpler case of ferromagnetic models where either you just have a fixed positive constant for the JXYs or random ones but all positive, which is based on a percolation approach to Ising models. And point out something which is also not very new, that kind of representation of Ising models or a version of it is available to try to use in models like these where the JXYs are both positive and negative. And then what's new is a particular idea as to how that percolation representation may manifest itself in the case of the spin glass phase transition, which this problem here is discussing. There's both some numerical evidence in the short range models, and there's actually a theorem about if you think of this as the spin glass model based on the nearest neighbor graph in ZD, then there's what physicists would call a mean field model. The spin glass version of the mean field model is called the Sherrington-Kirkpatrick or SK model, which has become quite popular in parts of the probability world because of mainly work of Talleyrand in recent years. And one can actually prove something about this percolation approach if one looks at that model, which is an extra bit of evidence that perhaps it's a good approach for the short range model. Okay, so I want to discuss some related percolation models. And here's let me just give some names. I'll explain what these mean in a moment. There's FK or Fortuyn-Kosselein, sometimes called random cluster measure percolation model. And then we're going to do. So this is a model which I'll tell you precisely what it is in a moment. It's a probability measure on what I would call bond occupation variables. That is to say, it's a certain kind of random graph model, but not in this context, the Erdős-Renyi type. Bond occupation variables, these are variables, one for each nearest neighbor edge, which take values 0 or 1. Saying whether the edge is occupied or vacant. And we'll talk about both called single and double versions. And the single and double versions basically correspond to whether you take a sample of size 1 from your probability distribution or a sample of size 2. So these are the physics languages would be 1 or 2 replicas. That is to say, sample of size 1 or 2. And the double percolation will correspond to the where I ask in the sample of size 2 that the edge be occupied in both replicas. And that, as I said before, these taking two replicas or sample of size 2 is somehow one of the few natural approaches to trying to understand spin glasses, because you don't understand directly what the low-energy configurations of these variables look like. So if you're trying to show something is ordered, a way of doing it is to take another sample and see whether the two samples behave like each other, roughly speaking. And what we'll be doing is the percolation version of that. Okay, so so the sample is from the Gibbs distribution or the corresponding percolation measure. That's all done once this J is fixed. Okay, so let me I'll begin with this FK, and I'll basically just define for you the probability measure on the 0, 1 valued variables. And think about you have to do something with boundary conditions and taking a limit, but think about a finite region. So everything is now a discrete probability or a discrete system. we're going to then just have a certain random graph model on the, let's say take a cube sitting in Z3, and I look at the nearest neighbor edges of that cube, and I want to define a probability measure telling me whether the edges are occupied or vacant. And so that's a certain kind of random graph model with spatial structure related to this energy, the corresponding energy function. So I'm going to define it for you in the sort of fastest way I know how to. There are slightly more elegant ways, but they take a little bit longer. So I'm going to define it in three steps. So I want to define a probability measure on these 0 or 1 valued variables, and I do it in three steps. So I begin with the simplest model, which is just a product measure corresponding to independently deciding whether the edges are occupied or vacant, except the probabilities will be inhomogeneous because they depend upon these JXYs. Right, the JXYs are already chosen. You have some real numbers, some positive, some negative, on this cube, on the edges of the cube. And now we define a measure which I'll call P hat independent. This is the measure corresponding to IID variables, these 0, 1 valued variables, which are 1 or 0 with probability related to the JXY. And at this stage, we only take the magnitude of J into account. We don't yet take the sign. So it's this probability of being vacant, and it's this probability of being occupied. Sorry? Yeah. So if beta is large and this is non-zero, then the probability is large that the edge is occupied. Okay, that's step one. Step two is to modify this measure by a rate on nicotine derivative factor, which is of the form 2 to the number of clusters. So here's P hat independent. So this is a probability measure on configurations of these edges. Look at a configuration of these edges. Once you have a configuration of the edges, you can then that decomposes the graph into connected components, which are called clusters. Count the number of clusters. That's a function of this configuration. And now modify this probability measure by a factor that depends upon the number of clusters. So it's 2 to the number of clusters, which is a function of this configuration of ones and zeros. I'm going to add in one more thing in a second. So this gives a bigger weight to more clusters. Makes it harder to percolate. Percolating means things tend to form into large clusters. This sort of prefers having more smaller clusters. But you want to keep it being a probability measure. Normalize it by whatever total weight of that thing would be. That certainly changes. It's no longer an independent product measure, but this is a somehow not dramatic factor. Whether or not a particular edge is there may differ from what it used to be by roughly a factor of 2 or 1/2 compared to what it used to be. Now, here comes a dramatic fact, and the first one, which this is all you would do if you were dealing with a ferromagnet. However, somehow you have to take into account the fact that some couplings are positive and some are negative, and that turns out to be taken into account the following way. now take this measure here and condition it on a certain event, that is to say, throw out all the configurations which don't satisfy, don't belong to this event, and then renormalize. So condition on the event U. So there's a term that comes in here, which will sound funny if it's the first time you've heard it. It's actually a technical term from the physics literature called frustration. I'll tell you what that means in a second. No frustration among the occupied bonds. So the reason why the ferromagnet is easy to understand is because when all the couplings are positive, you know how to get low energy configurations. You just make the sigma x and sigma y for neighbors be the same. That makes each term in the energy as low as possible because of the minus sign. But now suppose you have some positive terms and some negative terms. Well, then you might have a triangle of sites, x, y, and z, where the coefficients are, say, 2 plus and 1 minus. Then you can make these two agree, and you can make these two agree, but then these two agree, whereas you want them to disagree to make that term in the energy negative. So frustration means you can't satisfy all the individual terms in the energy function. And if you think about it for a moment, it's clear that you get frustration not just for triangles, but for any loop of occupied bonds if there's an odd number of negative J's. So no frustration among occupied bonds means you don't allow that among your occupied bonds. So that means every loop of occupied bonds has an even number of edges where the coefficient, that coupling, is negative. In that case, that loop has no frustration. You can satisfy everything on the loop, meaning each term in the energy function is as negative as possible, and if all loops have this property, then you can do that for everything. Now, this of course clearly depends upon the signs, and this is what makes this spin glass situation much more difficult to analyze than the ferromagnet. Okay, so that defines, do all these three steps. That gives a measure which I'll call p hat sub fk. That's the measure on defining a certain probability distribution on random graphs, which depends upon the JXYs and the beta, and it's the one which I'm now going to discuss how this is related to questions like this, although things involving expectations of products of sigmas. Okay, so first let me tell you what the in particular where percolation comes in. So first let me tell you how things look when you have a ferromagnet. If all the couplings are positive, then this property is automatically satisfied, and the measure you're dealing with is just this one. The JXYs are already positive, and in that case, there's a very simple formula relating quantities calculated in terms of this random graph measure and quantities defined in terms of the Gibbs measures, and then that gets a bit more complicated in the non-ferromagnetic case. So for a ferromagnet, if you want to do the expectation of sigma x, sigma y, so think about a finite system with no boundary conditions, you just truncate that energy function to the finite piece, and now I'm doing an expectation with respect to that measure. That's related to this measure, which I just defined by the following formula. Take this measure and look at the event that X and Y belong to the same connected component of the random graph. So that's usually written this way. This is notation for X and Y in the same cluster. Cluster is a percolation language for a connected component. So you have a random graph. Do X and Y belong to the same cluster or not? This is their probability. And that probability, which is a natural percolation type quantity, in this slightly, well, in the somewhat non-independent measure, is equal to a quantity calculated in terms of a Gibbs measure. This is not quite the same as this, but to avoid discussing boundary conditions, it's easier to write down this formula. And basically, trying to show that you have, roughly speaking, trying to show that for large beta in the infinite volume limit, this thing happens is more or less the same as saying the infinite volume limit, that these kinds of expectations don't go to zero as X and Y get far apart, which means in this language that there are very large clusters or that percolation is occurring. In the infinite system, percolation means that you have actually an infinite cluster. So this relates percolation properties of this measure to easing model properties in the original Gibbs measure. And furthermore, in the ferromagnetic case, let me write this another way to make the next formula look a little more close. So this, of course, I can write as the expectation in this measure, which I'll again use this notation for expectation. It's the expectation in this measure of just the indicator of this event. So I'm only writing it this way because in the next thing, this will make it easier to write what happens in the non-ferromagnetic case. And furthermore, broken symmetry in the ferromagnet is exactly equivalent to percolation in the FK measure in the infinite volume limit. So there's a precise theorem which gives a precise version of this statement and says that the phase transition for a ferromagnet Gibbs distribution of a ferromagnet exactly corresponds to the percolation phase transition for the related random cluster or FK measure. And basically the topic I'm trying to discuss is what may replace that relationship for spin glasses. Roughly the idea is that it's going to involve percolation, but it's going to be a more subtle property of a percolating system, and that my object is to at least get that idea across. Okay, but in order to get there, I have to tell you what replaces this formula already, say, in the finite system. So let me do that. So in general, so that means I'm no longer assuming it's a ferromagnet, so I have some general collection of JXYs, and I use all three steps to define the measure, then the formula is the following. So it's a modification of this formula as an extra factor thrown in, which I'll call eta of X and Y, where this is a sine, S-I-G-N function, namely, it's the product over edges in an occupied path. Well, first of all, this is irrelevant unless X and Y are in the same connected component. If they're in the same connected component, there's at least one occupied path of occupied bonds connecting them. Look at such a path. And for each one of those occupied bonds, see what the sign of the JXY is, and just take the product of all those signs. So that gives you a plus one or minus one for any occupied path. And this conditioning means that any two occupied paths gives you the same parity. As if you concatenate them, you get a loop, and this requires, that's just another way of saying that those two give the same. So this is a well-defined sign if they're connected, and that's all, if they're in the same cluster, that's all that matters. So this thing now is just a difference of if x and y are in the same cluster, it's the probability that they're in the same cluster with a even parity connection minus the probability that they're in the same cluster with an odd parity connection. So the basic the basic problem is that you can more or less see immediately from here that having percolation, meaning that you have very large clusters with things very far apart or connected, somehow tells you something very strong about back in the easing model. But here, if you want to get ordering, you also want to have very large clusters, so you want to have percolation. But now you have a question of maybe you have percolation, but you get a kind of almost exact cancellation between the cases where you have a even parity connection and odd parity, and so somehow you need something to determine that issue. Okay, so what's needed to get broken symmetry? Well, so let me first make a comment that so in one direction, to have broken symmetry, you really need to have that in the infinite volume limit you get percolation. Because unless you have basically infinite clusters in the infinite volume limit, then there's no way that sort of memory of boundary conditions can persist. Things have to be connected on long distances, but that's not enough because of this possibility of cancellation, but the implication doesn't go the other way. And so what do you need besides percolation? So percolation is not enough. It's more it's necessary but not sufficient. Not enough. And in particular, there are theorems that say that you do have percolation, for example, in the two-dimensional triangular lattice at large values of beta, but it's generally believed, both for theoretical grounds and numerical grounds, that you don't have a spin glass phase transition in two dimensions. So that's sort of consistent with this point of view, that just having percolation is not enough. So what's needed besides that? And the idea is that you need to look at some more subtle percolation type phenomenon. And part of that requires looking at these sort of two replicas, a sample of size 2. So consider two replicas. N and prime, same J. So that just means one's looking sort of at the product measure. And now consider doubly occupied bonds. So those are edges where both nxy and n prime xy for the two replicas are both one. So it would be it's not hard to show the following. It would be enough, as say enough to get broken symmetry, to have. So having a doubly occupied infinite cluster, doubly occupied percolation, that by itself actually doesn't buy you much. But if you had not just, by the way, let me back up a second. There are theorems about percolation, fairly general theorems, about when there are infinite clusters in an infinite system, how many can there be? Those can be applied to single FK percolation to show that when you have percolation, there's a unique infinite cluster. Those theorems don't apply to double FK percolation. And as we'll see, that somehow is crucially relevant. So in particular, it's not enough just to have percolation. It would be enough to have percolation with a unique infinite cluster, a unique double FK infinite cluster, and that's quite easy to show that that would be enough. But less than that suffices, and furthermore, the less seems to be what is actually going on, which is the kind of punchline. Less than that suffices, and there's numerical evidence, there's both numerical and theoretical evidence that that's actually what's happening. So let me tell you what the less means. The less is a unique double FK infinite cluster of maximum density. So I now want to talk about the possibility of having more than one infinite cluster, and whether or not two, for example, and whether or not you have both infinite clusters having exactly the same density or different densities. So there's evidence, which I'll talk about if we can get the things set up in a little bit. Evidence for the following: evidence that the spin glass transition, which is something which is kind of only known to exist based on numerical evidence at a certain value, a certain critical value of beta, has the following property. For beta less than beta c, but close to beta c, not that close, but not very small beta, but when beta starts getting the value of beta c in the units that will come up in the simulation, if I get to it, is beta c is something like 0.9. So already when beta gets to be around 0.4 or so, you start having a double FK infinite cluster, but you actually have two of exactly the same density. Two infinite clusters of the same density. I should warn you in advance that because spin glasses are very difficult to study numerically, also the level of precision of the numerical results is not exactly the kind one would like to see, but it's what exists. I should have said this way at the beginning. This is the more recent work, like the kind I'm starting to talk about now, is joint work with Dan Stein and John Machta from University of Massachusetts Physics Department, who is our numerical guru and also does other things. Whereas, on the other hand, when beta becomes bigger than beta c, then you get two infinite clusters of different densities. So that's the sort of the punchline. The punchline is that we are presenting evidence that this is the sort of percolation signature of the spin glass phase transition, not like the ferromagnet. You simply go from single FK percolation, from not having it to having it, but rather you go from rather you have a split between the densities of infinite clusters. And of course the problem is to prove that this actually happens, right? Well, that's I'll leave that as an exercise. but before showing you the, as I say, rather feeble but as good as we have numerical evidence that suggests this may be happening, let me give you some other evidence, which is that this is numerical. So this is numerical. Here's some theoretical, in the sense that there's another model where you can prove that something, somewhat like this happens, and that is actually the complete graph version or the mean field version. That's the thing called the Sherrington-Kirkpatrick spin glass, that's the one where instead of taking, starting with the graph, which is the nearest neighbor graph on ZD, you start with the complete graph on N vertices, and between every pair of things you have a JIJ. I won't bother writing down the formula, but in that case you can actually, there's a theorem that we've proved, it's not so difficult once you realize it's worth looking at. Theorem is that in this case there is a there's a transition, the double FK has transition. In this case it's a little different than that. Below beta C there actually are no double FK clusters. Transition from no infinite clusters. You don't have infinite clusters in complete graph models or mean field models. You have a sequence, that's the part that's related to the last talk, you have a sequence of graphs of larger and larger size, and percolation there corresponds to having a connected component which is of size of order n, where it's a complete graph on n vertices rather than some lower order size. That's called a giant cluster. There are no giant clusters for this kind of percolation. For beta less than beta c, which in this case is known to be 1 with the right normalization, and then you get two giant clusters but of unequal density for beta bigger than beta c. So the main part of this is this part. So this is not the same model, but it's a related model. And that's sort of evidence that this may be a reasonable mechanism for having the spin-glass transition. So the only thing I have left, which in the minus 2 minutes remaining, in this case I would not even guess, but actually here one actually knows the answer. Oh, and I should say that the proof here is based on comparison to the Eros-Renyi random graphs, where basically everything is known. I'd be better off not showing you this because the just remember that it's extremely difficult to do numerical work for spin glasses, and secondly, our collaborator Machte is one of the world experts in doing that. So, you know, these look bad not because we're sort of naive people who don't know what to do, but you know, it'll get better when there are quantum computers. So, I'm also lying. That is to say, the numerical things I'm showing you are not quite for double FK percolation, but somewhat different graphical representation, which has a similar spirit, but it would look similar, even slightly worse for the. So this is, of course, unfortunately, in numerical things, you don't get to work with infinite systems, so you work on a torus basically, and so these different things are the different sizes, and I can't remember the. As I said. It's really quite difficult, Markov chain Monte Carlo methods are hard to implement because it takes a very long time to equilibrate, and the sizes here I think go up to something like 12 cubed, maybe something like that, and this is a range of different sizes, and this is supposed to be a finite volume version of the number of infinite clusters, except what here you mean infinite clusters, one which wraps all the way around the torus, so it's called wrapping clusters, and so here this is beta, so this is beta, and 0.9 is around 0.9 is where a believed spin glass phase transition, this is in three dimensions, the believed spin glass phase transition happens, so somewhere around 0.3 you go from having no infinite clusters or no wrapping clusters in the finite system to having two, and then basically stays at two. Okay. So what's more interesting is this doesn't tell you anything about densities. That's what the next curve tells you. The different lines are for different sizes, so it's maybe 8 cubed, 10 cubed, 12 cubed, and yeah. So I believe it's the case that on the right side, the lower sizes are the ones that are a little farther down, so that things in the limit should be, you know, in the limit you should go from zero, should have a step function going to two, and then should be exactly two. So that's not so bad. It's better than the next one. So the next one is actually looking at the densities, the finite volume approximations to the densities of these infinite clusters. Well, these are really the wrapping clusters. So these are the upper curve. That's just the you take the two largest clusters and add up the numbers of sites in them and then divide by the volume. This curve is the total density of the two largest clusters. And so again, in the infinite volume limit, it's supposed to go from zero to something non-zero, and you know, that's something like that seems to be happening at 0.3. And that, you know, that you almost have all the sites in it once you get above 0.4 or so. These correspond to the largest cluster and the next largest cluster. So we're supposed to interpret this as meaning that basically in some interval you have two clusters of basically equal size. Of course, one is a little bigger than the other because it's a finite system. So the part that is a little hard to accept from the graph, but as I say, it's, you know, this is, you know, you would like to do not 12 cubed, but, you know, 100 cubed. That's just out of the question for numerical reasons. What you're supposed to believe, let me say, there's supposed to be a little bit of evidence in favor of the idea that what's really going on in the infinite system is that you have two things of equal density, which then split at the critical value, which is around here. Now, you know, certainly if you looked at that, you know, you would say, maybe they split over here. Right. Well, all right. I mean, there's a lot of work left to be done, but at least it's a working hypothesis. And we do have some other things I don't have to present, which is there are some different models in which, for different reasons, there also is a situation in which you go from having one cluster to two unequal clusters, but for completely different reasons. And just to kind of compare numerical things, we can do the numerics for those, and they're a little more convincing than this, but not all that much better. So. Okay, so I should stop. I've gone over my time. Thank you.